This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3594, for Thursday, the 12th of May 2022. Today's show is entitled Peely Wally in Edinburgh. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 68 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is Brooks and Dave Morris chatting about this and that.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Hacker Public Radio. Now, today we're doing another two-parter episode with myself and Mr. X. Hi, Mr. X, how are you doing?
Hello, Dave, how are you doing? It's good to catch up with you again.
Yeah. It's been a while since we did this one. I've forgotten how long ago it was. Was it in March we did it? I think it was, wasn't it? But
March.
The time just
right.
Whizzes by. It feels like last week.
It does. And I think at the time we said, oh, we must do a second part to this in a few weeks' time, and it's never happened, of course.
No. It's the few weeks thing that always gets you, isn't it? Things get in the way.
Yeah. I think the way things are just now, the world's so mad and everything, and it's just I'm kind of bad at catching up with people at the best time, so I'm really glad when you do catch up with me, because otherwise it just fly by. But I think you spoke caught me. I can't quite remember, but just on a wee note, from last time show, remember we were talking about dampers and stuff. Do you remember about
Indeed.
The dampers for
yes.
So I had myself, I thought, well, you know, I'm just curious, you know. So I did a wee search on YouTube, and in the link in our notes here, I actually found a rendition of the damper song, so it really did exist.
And
I was visiting my mother last night, and I mentioned to her about that, and she says, oh, yes, your granny that sung that song. She says, oh, yeah, it's one of the tamer ones she used to sing. She said, yes, I remember some other ones.
Oh, so we can share it on HBR without being marketed.
Oh, yeah, so that one's all right. I couldn't tell you any of the other ones, though.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, okay, well, that's great. I see it in your notes there, so I'll add that to the final show notes.
That's really cool.
It's always good to be able to follow up with these things.
I didn't realise it. I think it came from the Second World War. It was like that kind of era, so I think I didn't realise it went that far back. And I didn't know that there's bits of it where, the song is a very, very simple song, and then bits of it disappear as you go through the song, so you'll miss a little bit out, and then you'll miss a little bit more out until there's hardly anything to say at all. But I didn't know that. I guess my granny just sung one wee bit of it, I suppose, you know.
Yeah. That's the way with family songs and stuff, isn't it? Yeah. My father was stationed in India and Burma during the Second World War.
He
ended up with loads of weird songs, you know, like On the Road to Mandalay and stuff like that. He used to sing it to my sister and I when we were kids, and that somehow sort of stuck in my head, you know, all these sort of I suppose they're sort of marching songs and those sorts of things.
Right.
It's weird, isn't it, how you collect these things in your head.
And I guess at a certain age, a critical age, you're like a sponge and just soak everything up, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes it surfaces when you don't want it to.
That's right. It was actually a funeral. And we were around the table, and one of the relatives was saying, oh, yeah, you know, your mother, your granny, you remember, she used to sing those songs, you know, and she started talking, I can't remember how it went, and I thought, I really, really can't bring this up at this table, because it's so, so wrong, I can't possibly, no, I can't remember it at all, I had to say, you have to keep trying to put them, hope to heck that you never, ever remembered it, you know, so it's really embarrassing.
Oh, yes. There's a time and a place, I guess. But still, it's easily done.
Indeed. So you've been having a wee bit of, I see on your list, you've been having a catalogue of computer problems, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm not very good at absorbing the age of things. You know, I buy a thing and then I assume it's going
like
to keep going
well.
Forever.
Yes, I'm the same.
So I think I said last time I built myself a PC. I think it was 2013, so that's a long right. time ago. Yeah, it's nearly 10 years old, you know.
And yeah, and you think, of course, oh, I've not had it very long. How dare it break down? And you find that you've had it for 20 years under that.
Yeah. And it had all hard disks in it when I built it. Right. Not many, don't think. But I got the biggest disk I could afford at the time. And anyway, I've done various jiggling around with it and put SSDs and this sort of stuff in it. But so I had a 4 terabyte disk in there, which was where I'd put my home disk because I'd lost the other disk that I'd had it on originally. I managed to snag it before it completely died. And this one is failing. I need to do something urgently. The fail messages I get are through Smart. I've got a Smart monitor. I think you were asking about that or made a comment about that last time we were talking about it. I'm running a Smart monitor. I don't remember how I set it up now, but it's running out of System D.
Right, because I do remember that looking at Smart. So I was going to say that I think I've maybe told this story before. I'll make it very brief, but we were in Blackpool and me and a friend bought a hard disk, and it might have been a 1 gigabyte. So it was that thing was huge. It was like half the price it should have been. And, about a month later, his failed. And about a week later, mine's failed. His failed completely. But I was able to thump mine on the floor a few times and get it to power back up again. I managed to copy the... Yeah, I was very lucky. But I think on retrospect, what happened was it was about the time where Smart had just come into fruition. And obviously, they both reported Smart errors. We wouldn't have Smart on our machines, but at that point, and they both subsequently failed. So it just shows you. But I looked at Smart and Linux briefly, very briefly, and I think Clatu did a show on it. And there's some command line things you can run and whatnot. But I just wasn't sure how normally on a Windows system you have like a window that pops up at the bottom. And reports and tells you reports on your hard drive or whatever. I wasn't sure how you would automate all of that sort of thing so that it would warn you. That might be a good show.
Absolutely. I just set it up. I can't remember where I got the information from to set it up, but maybe it was Clatu's show that triggered me to look more into it or something. I can't remember that. But I've been running it for years, and these two incidents have been both alerted by Smart, and I get a pop-up window that says your disk is looking a bit yucky, or too many retries on it, or unable to write to a sector or something of that sort. You get quite a detailed breakdown, and you also see stuff in DMessage if you go and look. It's the way that I spot an error coming up, and that's the point at which I, in this particular case, copied my home directory off it to another disk.
Right, because I think I've got, it's a second-hand, was it Dell Optiplex 780, I think is just got the label here, but it was a second-hand office machine that I got online cheap, and it's a pretty low-spec thing, and I think I took the hard drive out of my old computer and added that, so I've got like two drives sitting on it, and God knows how old they are, and whether they're okay or not, it keeps working. But the thing I like about it is it's lovely and quiet. I could really do with adding some more RAM to it. I toyed with that. That would make a big difference, I'm sure. I've no, because everyone's now using these, flash hard drives. I'm spinning rust disks I've got in here. So
Yes. I've got a mixture of them because I'd bought SSDs as the prices began to drop, but they weren't very big ones, 250 gigs, that sort of thing. But I'd quite like to get into NVMe, but I don't think my machine will handle it. I don't think the virus will handle it. So I lost the 4 terabyte disk, found an 8 terabyte on Amazon, ordered it. I don't use Prime or anything, but it came within the week. So I was able to put that in, copy stuff to it, and everything was good. I mean, it was very risky, though I did make copies of stuff to some spare disks I had. One of the little HP ProLiant desktop-y mini servers or whatever it was. They were being sold. I think they were They were being sold by HP. Loads of people bought them. They were costing about £150 for this, with no disc or anything in it. But then if you bought it and wrote in, you got a refund of about £50 or something. So it turned out being only about £100 to get this. So I'd bought, and there's a lot of, is it four bays in there? So
Very good.
Can just open the front door and then slide out one of the bays, put a disc in, and away you go. But these are for hard disks.
Right.
They're SATA, but so you could put an SSD in there, but I don't know how the caddy thingies work with them. But So I had some disks in there. I was trying to use, what's it called? LVM, Logical Volume Manager, with a couple of disks. Yes. But either I was being really stupid, I'd screwed it up, so I'd left that project for a while, and I thought, I can grab that. They were like 2 terabyte discs, maybe. So Western Digital green ones, because they were cheaper. so I used them as my emergency backups. What I should do is actually put them in this machine, so I can do rapid backups if I need to.
It's a pretty I sort of have a very low-tech solution. I've got a fairly large number of Western Digital. Is it my book? Passport. That's it. It's a Western Digital passport thing. Uh-huh. So I've got, I must have 6 or 8 of these things all over the place, and I mirror each one. So it's a bit. It's not ideal, but it works, you know.
Yeah. I know what you mean, though. It's getting a really good backup scheme is a bit of an art. I years and years ago, when I was at work, because I used Linux all the time at work, I got into using a thing called Back in Time, which is meant to look similar to the Apple thing that's called something similar.
Right. Uh huh.
So I've run that now. I have an external disk.
Good.
So if I lose a file, if I delete something, then I can just call up Back in Time and find the thing in the last backup and then restore it very, very easily. You okay?
Yeah, sorry. I hit the space bar rather than my other key. So I stopped the recording, so that's handy.
That's okay. Whatever. We can stitch it all back together again, I'm sure.
Oh dear, not so good. I'm using the Alt-GR key, and it's right next to the space key. I'm not used to hitting the space key to do things, you know, so you just, I'll need to remember that. Oops.
I've got a key with keyboard with a numpad on it, so I'm using the 0 key on the numpad.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Which is a good, it's well out of the way of everything else, and I don't use the numpad much. But it's useful to have. I soon have a keyboard with one.
Yeah, so I like the numeric keyboard. I use it quite a lot at times. But yeah, but for this sort of thing, you could map it to that. Yeah, that's a good idea. And it's a big key as well. So
exactly. So you can't miss it. And if you're fumbling about like I do, which key is it? Oh, it's that one. Yeah.
My finger. I'll remember that. Yeah, very good.
Yeah. I've tried all the alts and controls and other things, but you find that they suddenly you try and. Like scroll or something, and scrolling doesn't work, or you know, you suddenly make your window smaller or something like that because it's mapped
of course,
to something.
Of course.
It depends what desktop you're using. I'm on KDE here, so there's a lot of key combinations already programmed. So you suddenly find you close your window without meaning to,
Yeah. So I was just thinking about that. Another issue you had, which my father-in-law has had a number of these problems as well, is you had a power supply failure, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Now, it's funny, you know, my father-in-law has had, I don't know, is it 3 power supply failures? It could be at least 3 anyway. And, and he's had numerous BIOS battery failures as well. And I've never had that problem, not once. And my machine's sometimes even older than his. And I'm coming to the conclusion that, in fact, his most recent problem with his BIOS, I was saying to me, I think all these problems you're having is because you're switching it off at the wall every night, and it's the right thing to do from a safety point of view and saving electricity and all this sort of stuff as well, and environmental and all that as well. But I think these modern power supplies use a an infinite and infinitesimally small amount of electricity compared to the sort of older ones. And if you think about it, your machine set up, at least most of the modern ones, have got like wake on LAN facilities, so they can turn on, you know, an IT department can bring a PC up remotely, sort of thing. So that they're intended to be left on. And I think turning them off and on leads to, my hunch is that leads to failures for the power supply and obviously the best backup battery as well, for that matter, you know.
Well, yes. You'd mentioned this before offline and stuff, and I've been pondering that one. I used to use a remote, you know, one of these radio controlled switches, you know.
So did I. Yes, thing. Me too.
And I would just press the button at the end of the day and switch it off. And, you know, after having shut it all down tidily and all the rest of it. And also, no, I didn't use the switch its power button off, but I would switch off from the mains with one of these things. So now that was killed by the dying of the power supply, and I haven't bought an equivalent, though I did buy just by the way, actually, I did buy a Sonoff one, which is you're capable of building into your IoT system if you want to, but it's just sat here where one of them's had its lid taken off, so I can see where the connection points are, so I can program it, and the other one's just sat there in this box, so I've not done anything about either of them
yet. Is that one of these ones that by default are set up to run with Google or something like that? Is that one of these smart?
Yeah, it's actually it's a Chinese company, and it uses their software, which you can put on your Android phone and stuff, probably other phones.
Yes.
It needs their servers to as part of the chain. So no way am I having that. I don't want any remote systems poking around in my house, including Google and Amazon. So the plan is to turn one of my Raspberry Pis into probably Home Assistant machine, which will control these things. So, but you can just use it as a standalone thing that's controllable by MQTT if you really want to. Primitive setup if you do that. So, I've got too many projects. I feel like that the cartoon man in front of two lips, and they both arrive at the same time, and just stands there frozen. Which one? So too many projects, and I can't seem to bring my brain around to starting on one.
It's good to have things to do. It's funny, I miss, because I'm busy with other things at the moment, I really can't get a chance to do very little Linux. And though just recently I managed to persuade myself to do a tiny bit of bash scripting, I mean, the most basic thing, and I based it on an old bash script that I wrote previously, but I couldn't believe how many mistakes I was making. I've forgotten all this, and then I look at the scripts, I'm making that mistake and this mistake. It was basically just a simple snooze script to make it a little bit easier to snooze mock, when I go to bed. I occasionally want to snooze it for 10 minutes. I don't use it very often, but just occasionally it's a handy thing to do. But I couldn't believe how rusty you get if you don't use it, you know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. When I was working my last job, literally last job I ever did, we were working on a VAX cluster originally, and the main development language for that was Pascal.
Pascal, that's right, yes.
So I used Pascal all the time. I was writing in it every day, you know, but if you asked me to write a Pascal program now, I could not for the life of me. I know it's got begins and ends in it, but I don't remember much else.
That's right. No, if you hadn't said that, I would. Also, it does, and you've got to declare everything. It's mad about declarations all that.
It's a bit of a toy language, but compared to modern languages, but it did the job.
This is it. Well, we had a tiny little bit of experience of VAX and also a Pascal, and then there was a visual version of Pascal. It's a Boron Pascal. I liked that. I was quite impressed with that. Boron Pascal.
Was it Delphi?
That was the one that was really, really popular.
I think they'd extended it quite a bit by then. I don't know whether it had object-oriented stuff in it or whatever.
Yeah. It's funny, the head of this software department had said, you know, because a colleague of mine, he actually became a software programmer, and two of my colleagues became software programmers actually, and I think there was a bit of tension between, see, the IT department and the software department about programming Borland that made Delphi actually. So Borland, they did
C++ as well.
That's right. And of course, their argument, where the software people's argument, well, the head of the software said, you know, it's a far better, far more rapid, easy to build things up in Borland than it is in Microsoft C++. And you know, I mean, because I was familiar with the Delphi one, I had a look at the C++. And obviously, the way that you can look up commands and help and stuff is really nice. And you look at the Microsoft one, and it was rubbish, absolute rubbish. I can see what you're talking about. It's just so clunky in comparison, you know. But they ended up dropping it, and I think they ended up going for the Microsoft one, of course. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's usually the way, isn't it? Yeah. One of my colleagues had written a thing in the Borland C++, and then he left. So I found myself maintaining this. I was sort of shoved into writing stuff in, never really had any training in C++. It wasn't a particularly complex thing, but it was it was doing quite a lot of networky type things, you know.
Right.
It was for students. New students come to the university would go to a PC anywhere on campus, and they would fire up this thing and they put in their matriculation card details, and it'd say, here's your username, because we created the usernames way before they arrived, and enter your password now, and here's your mail address. So this was the front end that let them do this, and so I wrote the back end and he wrote the front end. I ended up looking after both the back and the front.
The whole lot, yes.
It was sort of pre-web stuff. So, well, at least the web was very, very basic and primitive at that point, so we didn't dare use it for fear of being hacked.
I've got a tiny 1 week course on CE, which I didn't. I mean, I'm not quite sure. At that point, the company was happy to let you do bits training and stuff like that. I'm not sure it was particularly relevant to anything I was doing, because I wasn't even working I wasn't programming or anything like that. But it was, and everybody else that was on the course was way ahead of me, and I was like the dunce of the class, and I was just the slowest. Even logging onto the system and stuff like that, they were much quicker. They were obviously just more familiar with everything. But I didn't kind of enjoy it. But C isn't my favourite language, I mean, let's just say, you know.
No, I haven't written much in C. I have written a little bit, but not very much, and I wouldn't class myself as anything but a newbie in it. And it's a fairly simple language to get to grips with, but the sort of background stuff, the things that are not obvious behind the scenes, really difficult and bite you so easily.
Yeah, so it's so easy to get yourself in a mess with it as well. Of course, this is it. So
yeah, I know. It's certainly had that experience with the few C things I've written.
All right. So, no, thankfully, I didn't go that deep, so I was okay. But yes, indeed. Oh, well, there we go. So what else have you got on your on a list? I think I'm just wondering.
I was just listing some of the shows I've done, but that's not really very interesting.
Carry on. Yeah.
No, I'd started off writing these notes saying, "Oh, I've not done anything. I've not done any shows," and I started adding them in as I did them, because I've sort of woken up from the COVID sleep in terms of doing shows and stuff. So trying to do one a month or something like that.
Still waking up from that. So I got halfway through one, and I think I maybe did actually kind of half complete it, but I'm not happy with it. So I'm not sure, and I just can't. I think because also, you know, where I'm sitting here, this is quite nice. This is obviously very nice actually, and I enjoy these chats. But the position I'm sitting in just now is exactly where I sit on a day to day basis while I'm working, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's also a bit of a binding. I can only get to the setup at the weekend because I've got to dismantle it all and set it up for work. So it's a bit awkward, you know. So where in the past, at the weekend, during the week, I could write up notes and stuff. I can't really do that so easily. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's quite difficult, isn't it? Yeah, I know. I don't know. I just got out of the the habit of doing shows. Just couldn't quite bring get my brain in gear enough to do them.
I'm kind of like that as well. Yeah. This is it. So
gradually,
you can see how you can see how everyone's probably struggling in that respect. Maybe that's part of the reason why the show queues were it's been a wee bit on the low side. You know.
Anyway, we're getting back and we're getting shows in. Although, big surge, and that's great for a few weeks, and then you suddenly realise, oh, that surge is just about to end in a week or 2 weeks or something like that. We're going to be back in the hole again. So it's a strange sort of process of, as Ken puts it, feast and famine that you see.
Yes, indeed.
What can you do?
I obviously enjoyed your shows. They were very good, and you're always very thorough. I think when I listen to your shows, I like that. It's really nice to listen to. The images, and I remember you were saying in your notes about writing up some notes about how to deal with pictures and whatnot. I think I've only maybe once or twice sent in pictures. I think the first time I thought it was a bit daunting because I wasn't quite sure what was expected. So, but it must be difficult to deal with these sort of things.
Yes. It's the issue really is that the way that we do it is we put anybody's pictures or scripts or whatever in a subdirectory of the main directory where all the show stuff is held. And if you want to write notes that use it, you need to know which bit of path you need to provide to get to your picture. And that's not immediately obvious. So what I've said to people is, if you just send in your pictures by whatever means, I mean, with the show, it's preferable. You can put them all together in a zip file or a tar file or something, send them in like that. And then in the show itself, put some indicators, some comments or something like that that said, put picture one here, picture two here. Or preferably, if you call them picture one, picture two, that's great. And that's the order they're coming in. Or you can call them something relevant to what it is you're showing. And then just say, put this file name here and put that one there. And give it this title and those sorts of things. That's the sort of schema.
Yes.
And that seems to be working.
Yeah. It worked okay for me, I must admit. I think maybe that was whether I spoke to you and you gave me some advice, but I can't remember. I'm sure I used picture 1, 2, 3, 4, and that worked perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. That was nice and simple. So.
Yeah. So I've refined that so it's less detailed, less manual for me when I come to glue it all together, and I've automated it and stuff. But I do need to document it, as I keep saying. I'm not very good at getting to the documentation.
I can understand that. I'm the same.
It does need to be written up in some form, but I'll get that to get to that. I'm trying to do a regular amount of documentation. Ken and I need to share the way the bits of the system that we've built for our own use, because we sort of have our own areas that we work in. We need to document it so the other one can handle it.
It's tricky. I think you obviously just take ownership of a thing, and then it becomes sort of segregated from another person, and they're not aware of what's going on, sort of thing.
Yes, so it's not good practice to do things that way. So I'm currently writing documentation about stuff that I've done. And so I'm saying that I'm going to try and do so many an hour or something a week or something of that sort to just keep the documentation moving forward.
So I was talking about this new script I was writing. And then, of course, leading on to that, we were slightly off on a tangent. When I was with my current service provider, and they said, well, if you stay with us for another X number of months, then we'll give you X bits and pieces, and we'll give you a free, and you could either choose, a camera or an internet camera thing, or or you could get a smart speaker sort of thing. So, and the thing is, I would never have been the sort of person to get a smart speaker, but my brother previously, a while back, gave us a speaker, and you get one and you end up with two, and then, you know, spread all over the place. So now we've got two speakers, one in the kitchen and one in the living room. And so this internet provider supplied us with a free Alexa thing. I thought, oh, well, I haven't had an Alexa before. We'll try one of these. I didn't like during the sign-up process asking for phone numbers and stuff, which I left blank and all that. And I got it kind of working, and I thought, oh, right, I know I'm going to do with that. And I put it back in the box and I never used it since. And then Mrs. X was saying, well, you know, I've got this bedside radio here, and I never use it, and the buttons are getting sticky. You know, the rubber buttons are getting sticky, sort of thing. Because we try not to buy stuff, you know, because it's easy to buy lots and lots of gadgets and whatnot. So she said, "What about that? Have you still got that Alexa thing?" I said, "Yeah, just sitting in a box. Well, I could try that then." So we took it and plugged it in and whatnot, and oh, it's just couldn't get it to. It kept saying it was me, not her, and then you couldn't set up a voice profile, and you couldn't we couldn't get the BBC stuff to play BBC radio stuff. You had to link it to your BBC iPlayer account, which I wasn't very happy with. Tried that failed as well. It's just a load of old rubbish. It's going back in the box and forget about it.
yeah, that's a shame, mind you, but. Yeah, I know. It's a sort of trap in a way, isn't it? It's a snare to drag you into things that you probably don't want. I mean, you probably sat and thought about them. Don't you really don't want to have to be giving your details to whoever and whatever and stuff?
No. And actually, Alexa, you can buy things and get me some new toilet rolls and stuff like that. You know, but you could, you know, who knows? You could say, buy my new cat. You know, maybe mishears what you're saying, and you end up a new car or something. You know, not too keen on that, you know. So
yeah, I know. I've managed to avoid all of that stuff. Really don't want it.
Well, I wouldn't have if it hadn't been for my brother getting me one, and he said, you know, I bought you this. I wasn't sure whether you would like it or not, or whether you'd even accept it, because he thought I'd be quite kind of against it. Well, it's not something I would definitely buy. Actually, in fact, now that I've got it, it's quite good. The Google one's quite good, and you really find it quite useful. I don't think you can buy stuff directly from it, so it's a bit more passive, and you know the BBC content works, and you can sign up a free account with Spotify, so that doesn't cost anything. So you can play different kinds of music and what you can't specify unless you pay. You can't specify specific music. You know, I want to hear Elvis's second track on such and such. You can't do that, but you can say play some jazz or whatever, you know. And it's really very handy. And the one in the kitchen, you can be, you know, doing dishes or whatever, and you say set a 5-minute timer, and off it goes and does that. You don't have to get hands all over it all wet and what. It's just, you know, it's very, very handy.
Yeah. That I can see. Trouble is that unless you're tied in with somebody like Google or Amazon, then you know the you haven't got the resources, the computing resources to do that sort of voice recognition and that sort of stuff.
Absolutely not. It's all behind the scenes. But I mean, obviously, I've got a tablet and whatnot with Google on it, and so I'm quite comfortable with that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we've got two. And I think, you know, Mrs. X was so disgusted at the Alexa thing, and she started looking on the internet, and I mean, it's not like her at all, and she said, oh, look, they're doing this Google Home, which is it's one we've got downstairs, which is a kind of middle size, it's got a lovely, nice, rich sound to it, and it's old hat, because everyone's moved to these Nest things, which is even bigger, so they're actually flogging the there was one left in stock, and it was cheaper than the mini one, so it was, you know, less than half the normal price, so she that's now coming in, and that Alexa's getting just chucked.
yes. Maybe you can strip it down for bits of parts or
something. Well, yeah. Make something else. A speaker out of it. For something, that's right.
Yeah. the speaker might be quite good. You can drive it off a Raspberry Pi or something like that.
Yeah. I'm sure you're like me, that you don't like to throw anything out, you know.
No, I don't. Although it came back to bite me when I had to clear my attic. So much junk in there.
Yes.
What is that? 132 column matrix printer.
Oh no!
What would I do with that? It needs.
Crikey.
Do you remember what were the printer interfaces they had back in the day?
Oh, Centronics interface.
Yeah. It's a Centronics printer, I think.
Yeah.
With a massive big plug with lots and lots of connectors in it.
That's right. Yeah.
I used to write software on my BBC Micro and print stuff on there. It was nice to have 132 column papers.
Oh yes, of course.
My friend and I were developing stuff in assembler on the Beeb and printing stuff on there. So you had a nice big sheet of paper and you could scribble on the right hand side of it, you know. No, don't do this, blah blah blah. That was quite convenient. Yeah. Well that's a different era.
I remember at work, and it's a job I liked getting the job to do when I was just kind of quite young at the time. And you would go into they had a hut that you would go into, and you get going with a barrel sort of thing, and you bring in a big Diablo disc. It's a big it's a big pizza disc basically. I think it held, was it 5 megabytes? I think it was 5 megabytes. And you pulled the front drawer down, you slid it in, you clipped it shut, you hit, went from load to run or something like that. And the disc spun up, and then a flag popped up, which meant that the disc was ready to engage with it, with the hard platter sort of thing. And then you would get to the computer using flip switches and whatnot, and binary and whatnot. And then there was a keyboard you could load and print listings. And of course, so you'd pick the program, and it would. It would go for half an hour or something like that, and your big reams of paperwork. You bring the paperwork and the discs back into the factory sort of thing. So I enjoyed all that kind of stuff. That was good fun, you know.
that sounds very similar to some of the stuff I've done in the past. Those discs like a pizza were they had a sort of handle on the top. Is that the sort that you had?
These were really kind of quite flat. I'm trying to think how wide they would be. A fair old width. I mean, I don't know. Hard to say. Wow. 2 feet maybe? Not sure. But it's quite wide anyway. You know, mm-hmm. quite a wide mm-hmm. disc. Quite thin and flat. And I saw it once in a. It was a Xerox commercial of the Office of the Future, and the secretary slid this flat pizza thing into the drive bay. I think it was an American drive sort of thing, an American thing.
Okay. No, I had a job when I worked at Lancaster University. I was given the task of developing some networking software, and I worked on the software at Lancaster, but the compiler was only available by going physically to Liverpool University. So it was case right, you catch wow. the train with your disk, which I'd written stuff onto, and trot over to Liverpool and build the thing on a wow. on a little machine.
That's even that's a bit more remote than me just walking to the hut outside. You know, so, okay.
Yeah, the computer centre in Liverpool, not far away from where we've had various old camp meetings in the past.
Yeah. Wow!
Then I bring back the compiled thing and try running it on the machine we had, because at that point Lancaster was part of the Northwest Network, as it was called,
which
was an inter-universities network, and each node. So it was a sort of a network of nodes with leased lines in between them. And each node consisted of a particular class of machine. I think it was an ICT Mod 1. And nobody will know. It's a British machine. Nobody will know that anymore. And then those machines were connected to all the terminals and to the mainframe and that sort of stuff.
Wow.
I was supposed to be writing something for the terminal. Well, I know what it was. I was supposed to be writing a thing to enable broadcasts, the operators to broadcast a message to everybody in all of the universities, like Manchester and Salford and Liverpool and Kiel and Lancaster, to say, oh, we're going down in a few minutes and we'll be back up in an hour, and that those sorts of things. So I wrote that thing.
Crikey. Pizza will be available outside for you at 4 o'clock.
That's right. Yeah. All these people from Liverpool come running down the road. Oi, where's the pizza?
It's incredible. Yeah. Just how things have changed.
Absolutely.
Wow.
I must do a show on primitive networking back in the day.
Yeah. I think I can remember a little bit of VAX, and then a lot of the networking used, what was the company called that did it was running DOS. What was it now? It was DOS. Oh, I can't remember now. But they used coaxial cables with you had to terminate them and all that. You know, that's kind of remember that as well.
That sounds like old fashioned Ethernet, was it?
Yeah, that's right. Is it NetWare? Was it NetWare?
Oh, NetWare. Yeah, NetWare. We were in NetWare site, my last job, for a few years. So we had a lot of NetWare all over the place.
Yeah, that's right. And you had so many seconds. If you were reconfiguring the network, you would pull them apart, and you had so many seconds before the network crashed, sort of thing. because you had to terminate the ends, basically.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Mm-hmm. There wasn't much in the way of switches and stuff in those days, I suspect. Not the sort of resilient networking switches that you get these days. It would have been hubs and that sort of thing.
Very good. So what else have I got on a list here? Where could we jump to from here then, Alan? What about, I've got a wee thing about, I don't know if it's even really relevant, but the bad weather we had, but I suppose in Ubuntu you would expect that, I suppose. Did you have any damage during the bad weather at all, Dave?
No. I'm not quite sure why, because in the past with really strong winds, I've had tiles come off my roof, but everything seems to be pretty solid, probably because of the wind direction more than anything else. You know, if it gets under the edge of a tile, it can sometimes rattle them loose. But
my mother's had the odd tile. I said one tile, I think, came off once and landed on the driveway. And ever since then, she's absolutely paranoid about her car, and she'd be right at the front of the driveway. I was helping her with her. She's got a problem with her car at the moment, and I left my car at her driveway. She said, "Oh, you better not leave it there. It'll be fine." she might end up being right when I come back for the tail in the middle of the roof or something like that. You know?
Well, yeah, that sort of thing crosses my mind from time to time. But I had a roofer come in and do some work for me. You know, clean the gutters and that sort of thing. But he also did the ridge tiles on the top.
Oh yes,
and those are often a point of failure if you get some really nasty winds and stuff. Most of the other tiles have been replaced anyway, the ones that were loose. So. He was checking for that as he was up there. Not a job I'd want to do personally.
No, me neither. No, absolutely
but,
not. No.
Hopefully that means there's no incipient problems there.
Right. Because I think. Around here, I obviously walking with a four-legged companion, and the number of fences that had fallen flat, you know, my mother's fence, well, it was very rickety, and it fell flat, so she's had to get that replaced. And my father-in-law's got a bit loose, but he managed to brace it up with a bit of wood, which we had to go to a builder's merchant thing that somebody recommended to us. And we sort of went in and got the bits and pieces. So he's quite happy with that. So everybody's okay now, I suppose. And hopefully we're now into April. So we should be hopefully at the end of that. And of course it was nice last weekend, but of course this weekend's been a bit kind of windy and a bit dull.
Yes.
So
yes, it was. It's reasonable. I was out doing a bit of gardening yesterday, and it was fairly cold, actually. It wasn't, even though you know, the sun was out, it was still quite cold. It's about 10 degrees here, according to my little display here. That's not cold, really. It's sort of on the tolerable end of things, but there you go.
Is that on your display? Is this a mirror display thing you've got?
What's it called? Magic mirror thing, which isn't on a mirror. It's just on a monitor. I got a spare monitor on the shelf above my desk here, but that just runs day and night. I turn the monitor off when I go to bed, but the Raspberry Pi behind it keeps going. That's really useful. It's just telling me news headlines and the temperature and upcoming weather and this sort of stuff.
So. Yeah, because you were saying in that you got a little bit long in the tooth and it's not now easy to. Yeah. I know, but that's
absolutely
so painful.
That's one of those projects that I'm still. Is swithering? That's a Scottish word, isn't it?
Swithering.
So we'll add that one to the vocabulary. Actually, swithering.
When
I first came to Scotland 40 years ago, I remember somebody saying, "Oh, I've been swithering all day." What is swithering exactly?
All these things are going to just your head.
Yeah, it's lovely though. I enjoy all the different language.
Very good.
So I've been swithering over these projects. Which one to start? Well, just start one, you silly so-and-so, you know.
Because the thing is, it's actually, you know, I hadn't sometimes you're so familiar with some of these words that I hadn't even considered that it was Scottish, but of course it is, you get too close to these things,
I get laughed at for not saying them right and stuff. I mean, my children are effectively Scottish, having been brought up in Scotland, though they don't speak with much of an accent. But my son's girlfriend, she was brought up in the Borders area down near Bigger area.
Oh, right,
so
yep.
she's got a bit more of an accent. And if I say stuff like Peely Wally, she says, "What are you saying? What's that you said?" Did I add too much English to that? Peely Wally, you know. So I have to be careful. I can't use these as if I know what I'm talking about too much.
It's difficult. It was certainly not quite there, but I couldn't quite pinpoint what wasn't quite right.
But yeah, again, for the vocabulary, it means pale and wan and stuff, doesn't it? Is it sort of
bit
insipid and you know,
I think my mother-in-law used to describe me as being Peely Wally. That's right. So as soon as she was saying to me, "Oh, you know, a bit weather-beaten," that's much better. So that's obviously I'm out walking the dog so much, you know.
Aye, we've all been indoors too much lately, I guess.
So. Yeah, I think so. Talking about that, and so I've actually now back at work more regularly, and I've just counting some of the things I wrote here. So strangely, car park is about 75% full, yet the factory seems abandoned. It feels like a very strange atmosphere going back into the office. Feels like a previous lifetime, strangely familiar yet totally alien. Doing hot desking with new desks, new locations, and new people working. Basically, I'm only in once a week. I need to bring all my personal belongings, including paper, work, laptop, headphones in with me. Keeping track of everything is proving tricky, as I'm not always the most organized person at the best of times. The pace of office work seems frustratingly much slower than at home, yet paradoxically the day seems to pass much quicker. I'm now going in more often than that. I'm now going in sort of like 2 days a week. I've been kind of dragged in twice a week, which frustrating because I've got so much to do, and it's just slowing things down and trying to catch people and then trying to concentrate within the office is really difficult. And I overheard, it was an interesting conversation, something I'd never even contemplated with this two people talking in the office, and said they'd never worked from home, and had them commenting on more people returning to work, and then nobody had asked them how they feel about this and how safe they felt with all the new faces. So because you don't think about that, you know, all these because you think, well, they've been in work all the time, so they mustn't care about, you know, or not too worried about the COVID. But if they're seeing the same people every time, and suddenly all these new people appear, I never even gave that a thought. Of course, yeah.
Oh no, it's quite an issue, isn't it? Yeah, it's. I don't know. I'm obviously not having worked now for the past nearly 10 years. Is it that long? Yeah, more than 10 years. Then, you know, it's not a thing. But I did used to work at home a fair bit. My work would let me, you know, go and have some quiet time developing stuff at home and stuff. But
of course, they've now in Scotland, they've now, you know, no longer need to wear a mask, and so that happened on a Monday there. And although they said in an email, you know, well, but we do still recommend where you're in public areas to wear a mask. And I was quite pleasantly surprised how many people were still wearing a mask. But you know, as more and more people don't wear a mask, you feel self-conscious, you know, and there's all these sort of things. And then other people say, well, if they're not wearing a mask, why the heck should I wear a mask? And it's a difficult one. And I understand that you've got to live with eventually live with this thing, you know. But at the back of my mind, it all depends on how. To my mind, what matters above all else is how is the NHS coping? That's what matters.
Yes, indeed. I mean, people are still getting it and getting it badly if they've not been vaccinated, or they are have immunological problems that prevent the vaccine from really being very effective. So, you know, it can still kill in those sort of cases.
So, and the thing, and even with the most virulent variety, you know, it's so spreadable now that maybe the masks are less effective, but it still means, because I remember that Dr. Campbell man saying that I've occasionally listened to him, he was saying that that the viral load is important. So if you've got a mask on, you know, you're going to get less of a viral load as you're, as you're walking through the particles or whatever. So even if you are likely to become ill, you're likely to become less ill or less likely to become ill, something. So it all helps, you know.
Yeah, my neighbours, I said this last time, I can't remember, their little boy went off to nursery, I think he's at nursery age, and when things started to ease up and came back home with the COVID, no sign of it, they all got it, you know, and they were, they didn't have very serious effects. They're a fairly young couple. And they've got another young child. And everybody had it, but only in a fairly mild way. So, but you know, it's just
but then it just takes one of those to. Yeah. It just takes one of those to get somebody, it makes somebody else really ill.
Your granny thereafter who maybe is more susceptible and you know, the kid's got it or whatever, then it's going to be pretty devastating.
It's interesting. I was speaking to a friend and a few people actually. And so I was speaking to a friend and he was saying, all the family have had it. Every one of them have had it apart from me and the wife, he said, you know, and he deals with the public all the time. So he can't understand how he hasn't caught it, and he can't understand how his wife hasn't caught it. And one of their daughters, she went to work for the first day at work, and she came back. Now, it wouldn't necessarily have been at the work, she got it obviously so quickly, but she came back and tested positive the next day sort of thing. So, and then I think some of my wife's friends were saying similar sort of things where they've just never had it and they would have thought they would have. So maybe that whether there are some people that just won't catch it or whether they've had constant sort of fine, what's the word, they've been, I can't think of the word, but they've basically been subjected to it all the time, and so they've come out immune to it some degree.
They've built up immunity, Only it's certainly the case that some people are more affected by it than others. You know, some people's just basic genetics or immune systems or whatever just shrug it off without any great difficulties, but yet their immune systems will be triggered by it, but they won't be very ill or even notice that they're ill. Because they've been saying, you know, if you are prone to hay fever, seasonal allergies, as people would put it, then you need to be cautious that you don't ascribe the symptoms to just a hay fever, and it could be COVID. So doing a test might be a smart thing to do, you know, particularly if the symptoms are a little bit unusual. But it's hard to say. I had a really nasty bout of hay fever. At my age, you're supposed to shed it. You're supposed to stop it when you get into your 50s, 60s, but I'm still getting it.
You know, I think I discussed this. I mean, I don't really, and I feel it's the strangest thing. I have suffered with hay fever all my life, and sometimes really quite badly as well. I couldn't open my eyes and really bad, and just a wee second, I'll just see if I can, I think I've got a bottle here, hold on a wee second. Yeah, here it is. So, I've got this stuff, it's advertised as mixed pollen, but then it says this 30C, which is this concentration. Now, obviously, is this not this, what do they call it, but it's such a small amount that it can't possibly do anything. So, it's basically, you know, it must be, what do you call it when it's in your mind? It's, what's what I'm looking for?
I'm suddenly having a blank. So.
Yeah, you know, it can't possibly do anything because the concentration is so...
Psychosomatic or
something like that. Yeah, that's right. Now I've had really bad hay fever all my life. And I think when I got this, I didn't realise what this really was. And I took it. And when I took it, I thought, this isn't going to work. Because I've tried all kinds of things. I've put stuff up my nose with the ultraviolet light and all that. And I've tried there's even this high-tech stuff that's supposed to charge particles, it's supposed to get minimise pollen going up your nose, and all kinds of stuff I've tried. Nothing's worked. This worked, and I am virtually cured of hay fever now, and I can't explain it. I cannot explain it at all.
It's hard to know, because if you look at it from the point of view of an experimental study, then you do not do studies on one case. You know, you only want hundreds, thousands of people in all going through some sort of regime that says they were bad behavior given this thing. How many of them recover? So, you know, if it's just you. Because, I mean, not to throw cold water on this idea, but, you know, if you just happen to be at the point where your immune system has backed off getting bothered by this thing, because it's a nonsensical thing for your immune system to do. But if it's just, you just happen to have reached the point where it said, okay, that's the end of this, and you know, it would have happened anyway, you know.
It almost seemed the day that I started taking this, you know, it defies logic. I know it doesn't make sense. It shouldn't have worked, and yet it's almost. I mean, I must be 95%. I can walk through cut grass fields, and I think I sometimes get a tiny wee bit symptom. And again, I've got to get this bottle. I think the first time I took it, you know, I maybe took 10, 12, and one year. These pills or so, and then the next year I was down to about 3 or 4, and then I think last year maybe I took one or something like that, maybe none at all. So I'm basically cured. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing. I can't. It defies logic. That's the bottom line, you know. Yep. So I don't know.
Well, if you're out of it, then good luck. That's amazing. Yeah, that's really good, because it's a miserable process.
Oh, it is. It's really. And you know, the thing was, when I bought the pills, it's just sugar, isn't it? It's nothing at all. The fake medicine. When I bought fake medicine, there was all these claims. People were saying, "Oh, it's really good." Some people say, "No, I didn't work at all." But there was a lot of people that were quite positive about it. But of course, they could all have been fake reviews, I suppose. And I think there's a lot more of these fake reviews now. But yeah, who knows? But you could give it a go.
Well, what happened with me was, I get a prescription every 56 days, because I'm on quite a lot of tablets for various things.
Right, right.
And one of the things I put on the, I get to fill in the request, you know, every 56 days what I want for the next batch. One of them is cetirizine, which is an immune suppression thing, antihistamine, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
Which I find works for me fine, but I had not appreciated that there was going to be a pollen surge coming up, and I was hit by that before I got my cetirizine, so it was that really destroyed me. You know, as you come out of the winter where there's not much pollen around, and you go into the spring where a lot of the wind pollinated trees start up, then there's quite a lot of relatively large amounts of pollen in the air. The forecasting websites will show you stuff about pollen counts and stuff, and they don't trigger it, but I think I'm maybe just allergic to particular tree pollens that get me going.
I think when I'm cutting the bushes at the front, that can sometimes trigger it, or has done it in the past. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, it was really grass pollen, because my mother would always say, you know, oh, you need to stay away from the rapeseed. No, that doesn't bother me at all. It's grass. Grass is the thing that really, really triggers it, or did. And, you know, I have had various antihistamine things, and cetirizine is definitely one I've tried. I can't remember if that was the most recent one, but what I do remember, again, being peculiar, because I was given one of the more modern antihistamines, and they're supposed to be, you know, not make you drowsy sort of thing. And I remember taking it and being really, really drowsy. And I sort of mentioned it to the doctor, and I said, oh, this more modern one shouldn't do that. Maybe we'll try one of the more traditional ones, but you might find you get tired with that one. And I can't remember what it was, but anyway, I was fine with that one, and it suppressed the so it just shows you, you know, everyone's different, basically.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. It's once I got onto the cetirizine, I was fine again. I take one tablet a day just now, so that just keeps it at bay. I thought I could stop it when I reached this age, but obviously not.
Well, I think just recently I may have told them to remove the antihistamine from my prescription, because I've just not needed them at all. So, it's just. amazing. I just wish I had this had happened 20 years ago, you know, because I feel your pain, Dave. It's horrible.
Yeah, the weird thing in my case was I was a student in the 1970s in Manchester, and I got asked if I wanted to help out on one of the field courses that they did in the department. This was a biology or a zoology department, actually. And the field course was the undergraduate students would go en masse on a coach to a field place down in Gloucestershire. And they would spend a week doing various observations and studies and statistics and writing up what they were doing and stuff. So I joined in with this and was helping out. And that was the year where there was an incredibly hot summer. It was the year when all the ladybirds were landing on people and apparently biting them.
And can you remember what year? I think I can remember that,
70,
actually.
I don't know, 76, 77?
Right, yes, yes, I remember that.
Sure.
Yes, I was pretty young at the time, but yeah, I remember that.
What they were doing was, the ladybirds, was that they were looking for moisture. So it was hot, so they would have sweat on your skin, and they would come and try and drink it, but they don't have the mouth parts to do that without, because they're predators, and so they got some pretty vicious mouth parts. So they tended to nip people.
They
didn't actually bite, but they just nipped in the process. So people were getting covered in these things and panicking. But the point of the story was that I remember going into this area. This was a sort of field study centre in a valley in Gloucestershire. And one area that we went to do some study in was just a field of grass, just grass from as far as you could see. And as you look closely, you could see there was a sort of haze over the grass. And it was because the grass was at the stage of maturity where it was generating pollen. So it was like you were in a totally pollen atmosphere. And I had not had hay fever until that point. And then after that, I had it for the rest of my life.
Yeah, it just got that, but it triggers it, and then that's it. Yes, that makes sense. Of course,
I didn't realize that would happen, but So it's
So perhaps if you had never been in that area, you maybe we never would have got it. It's bizarre.
It's possibly so. Yeah, I don't know that caused in quotes hay fever, or whether it would just, you know, I'd had it in some mild form, but this sort of increased the reaction to it or whatever. I really don't know how that works, but
And of course that's you could go in another big route about that, because there's so many people having autoimmune diseases around the world now. It's on the increase everywhere. Isn't it?
And absolutely,
and nobody quite knows exactly is it plastic pollution, is it chemicals, what is it, you know. We all seem to be suffering from rhinitis. Have you heard of rhinitis? Runs in the back of your throat, sort of thing. So, and I've had steroid spray for that, and so I think I've suffered from it. My mother suffered from it. My mother and father-in-law have suffered from it. I think the only person who hasn't is a four-legged companion and my wife. You know.
Yeah. Oh, the autoimmune stuff is a real pain. It really is. And more things that have been, you know, causing people problems over the years are being ascribed to autoimmune stuff. My mum had quite bad rheumatoid arthritis for a number of years. That's an autoimmune thing.
Because it attacks the bone. Is that what happens?
Yeah, it does. It does. Yeah, you get your particularly your hands get all distorted, and you know the knuckles all swell up.
Yes.
She had it. Yeah. No, she had it, and then it disappeared after, you know, maybe 10 years or something like that. So I don't know quite what that was all about, but. Yeah, sorry, what were you going to say?
Like a flare-up, yes. My mother-in-law, she's my mother to a little degree, but my mother-in-law suffers from that. So, yeah, it's not nice.
No. It's surprising the number of things that are caused by that.
Yeah, actually, one of my mother's friends, I didn't know you could do this. She must have had some arthritis as well. And I think they scraped it, whatever that means. That sounds horrible. And then they set the bone so that the big toe now can no longer bend. But that's cured all the pain, sort of thing. So that's a novel way of dealing with it. I suppose it means that, you know, you scrape it, but then set it. So yeah, that's interesting.
Yes, as I understand it, it's due to inflammation in the joint, so that the sort of cartilage surfaces of the two halves of a joint that rub against one another normally, and it's all lubricated and everything, that all inflames, and in many cases it wears right through, and so you end up with a really swollen, painful joint as a consequence. I'm probably, you know, not giving a very good explanation there, but
that's
my understanding. But mum's time, they would do these things sometimes where they would effectively fuse the joint so that it becomes rigid, and that gives relief,
right,
because it's you're no longer bending and getting all the pain from damaged cartilage and whatever.
So that's obviously what my mother's friend went through as well, exact same thing, so that makes sense. I never knew that, so interesting.
Fun times
indeed.
Or not.
I hope I never have that problem, but I think it's very, very common, isn't it? So
I know. I just on the medical front, I just recently I've got a thing called trigger finger, which is where as you clasp your hand, one of your fingers stays locked in that cold position and you can't open it out again. And that's due to a nodule on the tendon, because your fingers are driven by tendons from muscles in your arm.
It's a bit like I'm trying to think, a mechanical equivalent where you pull it and a latch, almost, it latches,
it
sort of thing.
It does latch.
A latched finger.
That's why they call it trigger finger, because it has a much longer medical name, which I can't remember. But it means things like you can't straighten the finger because the tendon's jamming in one of the sort of sheaths that it moves in.
Oh, dear.
And then this thing where you grasp things and it goes clonk and it won't open up again.
how do you release it? You use your other hand and just...
Yeah, if you just move the tip joint of the finger backwards a little bit, then it releases and comes free.
So
I got steroid injection in my hand, which is eased enormously. It's not fixed yet, but they do an operation to scrape the tendon, apparently.
More scraping. Come to cannabis, isn't it? All scraping, you know.
Back of a spoon or something, I don't know. But I don't know why I like sharing these things, but I'm always fascinated by the mechanics the physiology of, well, anything really. Being a biologist, I enjoy it.
it's like you said, you know, if you're a doctor, it must be terrible to know about all these things that could potentially go wrong. We did mention
absolutely.
That in the last episode.
Crikey.
I'd never heard that. So that's fascinating.
Look it up, because I'd not really heard of it. My neighbour has it as well. He's got a young guy. It can be caused by diet and various things that cause inflammation
because I was thinking, you know, is it somebody who's been using a machine gun a lot, or maybe a road drill or something like that? So I didn't know you worked on the roads today.
Maybe some of those things would do it. That business of the white finger thing that you get when you're using
a
vibrating
finger,
road drill or something. I don't know much about that.
No, me neither. Wow, how did we get to that?
I know. I think our audience might be turning off in droves.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. Maybe a good point to end. I think it is.
Actually, we're over an hour again. So
didn't time just fly?
I know. Last time we did start recording a bit before we started doing the show for real. But still, we're still around an hour. And last time I thought I'd be able to cut out a fair bit of silence and stuff, but there weren't that many. we talked pretty silently.
There you go. Very enjoyable indeed.
Yes, it's always fun to chat about all these things. So yeah, we must do it again when we've built up our stock of fun
next time,
things to talk about. Preferably not too much in the medical area, perhaps.
Yes, indeed, perhaps.
All right then. So thanks for listening. If you haven't been listening, well, we don't thank you at all. And so don't forget to continue listening to Hacker Public Radio, and goodbye from Hacker
Public
Radio.
Yay.
Okay then.
Cheers now. Cheers. Bye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.